so sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay this man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they gonna say? No? I don't want to see those returns.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know that.
That's it. I'm done.
Law and Order by Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Matt Byrne on the board. Jim Waller in studio. Chef Mr. Chad Flanagan in a little bit. Ordering a little later. So, rather than listen to us, Matt wanted to listen to music. Was that a better idea? What do you think, Jimmy?
Different, but I do like the song selection.
Oh, yeah, maybe more soothing than listen to us, eh? Although the market's way up today, that's soothing, right?
Well.
You just close your eyes, pour money in a system, have your statement comes every month, make a bunch of dough, and then in Trumpy we trust thee.
Say too.
So it seems to be the program. You go somewhere, you threaten all the stuff, you go there and you say, everything's okay, and then they come back and everything's up even more, and everybody's wealthier. Even without anybody making a dime, just wealthier. I kind of love this. I'm not sure why exactly gold is getting trounced in this whole mess, but the dollar is getting stronger. That's probably why. Fortunately, we have some puts there, but what do you make of... there's a million things going on in the world. It's pretty hard to... And I wonder if that's kind of the story. You start a million brush fires, nobody can really concentrate on one. It's really kind of hard for the press to keep up, even if they wanted to. But is Congress disbanding? I mean, was that what they're doing? Are we talking about the Enabling Act, where they're just gonna disband?
Yes, yes, exactly. They'll just disband. You know, sort of like in what 34 in Germany, when he just basically said...
I think it was 32, but it was in there somewhere. 32, 32, 34, what's the difference?
Whatever. Yeah. Why have a government? Just let me do it.
Yep, well, that's what we're... Yeah. Looking like we kind of do that, but... So what do you make of... last week we talked, or actually a couple weeks ago, we talked about the Penn State coach firing and getting $40-some million. Now, Kevin might call in this morning if he gets a chance to talk about the Brian Kelly firing down at LSU.
As they say, say two, which means that's all.
Yeah.
And I guess, as it's pretty common in Louisiana, the decision was made in the governor's mansion.
Well, here's a... I don't necessarily really care if guys get fired. I'll tell you what, there's one guy, the guy who runs the Buckingham, he's the happiest man on earth today. He couldn't stand Kelly, and he's from LSU. So he's the happiest man on earth. But
well, I don't know if LSU is that happy. I mean, they got to come up with some money, and they now have to figure out how to come up because they have not reached a resolution yet. They're on the hook for $53 million?
I think it's a little more. I thought it was close to 60. Well, that is close to 60. Say it's in there somewhere.
Yeah,
they're trying to get some sort of a deal with him. I don't know what he wants to do that.
Right. Well, yeah, they want a deal or see if they can ship him off to somewhere else and see if they'll cover part of it, because I don't know if the state of Louisiana wants to come up with all the money.
And well, somehow everybody...
LSU stands for Louisiana State University.
Well, somewhere along the line, people, the alumni get so involved in this, which I really can't understand, but... They can't wait for these guys to how can I put this without being as gross as possible? Guy who went to Notre Dame, it's great to have get a nice football game on a Saturday, but you know what? When they won or lost, I still had to do my homework one way or the other, and when they won, a certain appendage never grew an inch. I got the idea you can only bask in the reflected glory so far, which meant a couple hours after the game. That's about it. I mean, it was great to see them win. It was great to see a major college event have that kind of excitement on a Saturday. So, I thought that was really neat, and still do to this day. But it is what it is. It's a college football game. How many games in a century have we had already? And it's only 2025. About 50.
I guess. Sports is a nice distraction from the everyday life. You have 3 hours, and then life goes back to normal.
Or back to whatever it is.
Exactly.
Whatever you want to call it, normal or not. But this is what I mean. This is kind of a weird thing today. I mean, I want to just, when I say weird thing today, another stupid thing that I think about. When you look at the college, first of all, what do you want to look at first? You look at the college, the mentality here. Everybody is signing these guys, these saviors, for 7, 8, 10 years at, you know, huge amounts of money. You know, the guy in the Penn State was making 8. What is Kelly making, 8 or 9? Kelly's making 10, right?
10. Almost 10, yeah.
So, but then you sign him for like 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. You want to lock him up. Well, you look at the situation. Situation meaning college ball. You're paying all these guys. People are flying back and forth every year. You're at a point where you need a general manager because the coach can't handle really all the X's and O's, the current team, all the politics that has to be flying in these places regarding who's getting paid what and who's starting, who isn't, those kinds of things. And the you know, the pettiness that people have at any age, let alone at age 21 and 22, for God's sake. And you look at the top teams here, looking at today's rankings. You got Ohio State 7-0, Indiana 8-0, Texas A&M 8-0, Alabama 7-1, Georgia 6-1, Oregon 7-1, Ole Miss 7-1, Georgia Tech 8-0, Vanderbilt 7-1, Miami of Florida 6-1, BYU 8-0.
What about Indiana?
They're number 2, 8-0.
8-0.
What I'm saying is, as you look at this, they all at some point play each other. Right, and if you go down to the 20th team, there are only like 2 losses there. They play all the schlumps, but then they pretty much play each other 4 or 5 times a year. If in the SEC, God help you, if you're Florida, you play ranked teams, 7 or 8 times? They got the worst schedule ever in the history of the world. Well, you put this person in there, whoever he happens to be, he could be Solomon, for God's sake, and you say, okay, boy, if he loses 2 or 3 games, we got to fire him, and we got to pay him for 7 years. No, we got to get another guy who's our savior. And yet, you give no room in there anywhere for any bad stuff to happen. Injuries, guys don't come out of the portal, aren't as good as you thought. There's a few guys on the team that don't like the other guys because they're paying more. But they're well on their way to being essentially a professional league, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay, so now fast forward over here to the NFL. When you become a professional league and you want this, quote, parity, which some would joke and say mediocrity, you've got people that you want to have 25 teams that are sort of even, right? Or 30 or whatever. What was the NFL? 30?
32.
So you want these teams that are pretty much all even. So if you hire Andy Reid for $20 million, Or the guy on Harbaugh, and all of a sudden you get all these injuries, or you have some kind of a problem, and your team is like the Ravens are 2-5. You can't call for Harbaugh's head because you know how tough it is to win a game because it's now even. So I'm saying what the colleges are striving for is essentially the pro model, but in the pro model nobody's 10-0 because everybody's pretty much even, right? So,
True. So
you can't fire your coach every week because he lost the game. Pay him $60 million and get the new guy. I mean, in terms of a business deal, how is any kind of a relationship? And I've got the Browns here, or the Bengals are 3-5. The Bengals were supposed to have a really good team. Let's fire all those coaches. You know, the Dolphins, this guy Tua can't quite make it out of the... Now you've got the Jaguars, you got the Texans, which were supposed to be real good this year. They were a playoff team last year, weren't they?
Yeah.
They're 3-4. Let's fire that guy. You get another guy if you're going to fire a guy, at least fire him, give him a 1-year contract or a 2-year contract. You can't give an 8-year contract and fire a guy every 3 weeks. I mean, it starts to get to a lot of money, doesn't it?
That is true. I do want to just, little side note, if you didn't watch ESPN and Rex Ryan breaking down, Nick Mangold, the former Jet center, passed away at 41, I guess.
Yeah.
He had a kidney disease. But that is That's tough. 41 years old.
I wonder if he was a Roy guy.
Could be. They're just saying he had kidney disease.
You can have that without being a Roy guy. I mean,
that's true.
Yeah, stuff happens.
That is true. But I mean, the guy played 14 years and missed once. He played less than 14 games in his entire career.
That's pretty good.
For a center, that's really good. 11 years.
Well, those guys usually, out of all the positions, interior line, those guys I think last the longest for some reason. They're blocking the guy right in front of them. They don't usually run and hit somebody. I'm not saying it's easy. Maybe it's the least exposed spot. Let's put it that way. Because a lot of centers last a long time.
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, you know, I take, Jason Kelce, who had to, as he said, basically get piled on in the tush push.
Yeah.
Because it's like, he's like, I move forward and then everyone piles on top
that
of
is,
me.
That is so dangerous. I can't, but the owners don't care.
No. Win.
But I'm saying, in general, he's least exposed to, like, being rolled over by tackles. And I mean, everybody's position's hard. But I'm going to say you probably have more centers with that kind of a playing record that played 12, 13 years, missing very few games in any other position.
I would agree with that, yes.
Especially since when they center it back to either extra points and punts now, you can't just run into the guy and kill him like this.
Their biggest problem is not hurting their quarterback. It's how many centers step on their quarterback's feet.
Yeah.
You know, but that was the other thing, you know. Unfortunately, we had to watch the Bears two. When was the last time you saw two intentional groundings in a game?
I don't know. Your guys were, of course, saying how the referees were against them. They both were intentional grounding.
One of them, it was questionable. There was a receiver. I mean, the receiver has to be within 10 yards, correct?
It's got to, sort of. You got to be going in that direction. Plus, if you're out of the pocket, like out of where the hash marks, you can wing it. I think there's a bunch of different rules.
Right. When you're out of the pocket, one of them, clearly it was. He threw it and there was nobody there. I mean, and it's kind of weird because you're right. You could be in the pocket and throw it out of the end zone, and that is not intentional.
Well, if you throw it over his head out of the end zone, that's always been good.
Yeah. You could throw it over out of the end zone. As long as someone's in the end zone, you're fine.
Yeah. But, I mean, basically, when somebody's breathing down his neck and he does something, it's sort of on the quarterback to make it look good at that point.
True.
And, you know.
Well, you know, going on that, the Jets finally won.
Yeah.
So we will see.
Everybody at some point, I mean, you see this kind of mishmash in the pros where, especially with teams that are playing on Thursday nights and Monday nights, you see this mishmash in this long period of, 17 games. So it's an 18-game season, right? Or 18-week?
Yes, 18 weeks.
So it's who coined the phrase, it's not who you play, it's when you play them?
That's true.
I mean, these guys are all, well, that's what I was kind of trying to say regarding the college and the pros. The pros have figured out that the league's goal is pretty much parity. You know, and you can be a wag and say that's mediocrity, but it's pretty much parity. I mean, I don't see ever again, well, ever is a long time, somebody going 17-0, do you?
Nope.
I mean, they're so even that they're just going to be weeks where the crummiest team, say the Jets, can anybody lose to New Orleans? Do they have a win?
I think New Orleans has won.
I think they do, too.
Who
the hell could they have beat?
Let's take a look.
But you really don't want, well, it's not like you don't want a team to go undefeated. The way you're setting the thing up, there's going to be weeks where the number one team has 4 and 5 people out, just when the crummiest team's getting their 4 or 5 people out back, where the crummiest team probably is actually better than the number one team, right?
That is true.
I mean, it just happens that way. You know, it's, I mean, that's what's so interesting about Major League Baseball. You have the world's greatest team going up with their fifth starter against the world's crummiest team with their first starter, and that particular day, the crummiest team is better than the best team, right? I mean, look at Carlton's career. Whenever he pitched, they were the better team, pretty much, right? I mean, for at least
that's
a couple
true.
Of years.
And no, New Orleans is 1-7.
Who are the schlumps they beat?
That I don't know, but they are 1-7. Let's click on and find out.
You know, so on one hand, you want everybody. Now, in college, obviously, you don't. You want to have, you know, 10 of your games where you're winning 40-6. But the more you go toward the pro model, the more you're not going to do that. And the more you're not going to do that, the more you can't. First of all, I never liked Kelly, so this is not a personal thing. But by and large, so are we going to have, what, 4 or 5 Cannings this year where we owe people $50 million and the next guy is going to be, you know, going to win every game every year? That's not going to happen because you got 25 teams doing that. Or is it just me? You know, it sort of seems that way. Meanwhile, S&P Futures are still up 56. NASDAQ Futures up 325. Gold's down like $67. That's kind of a lot. So we have odd things going on in the market. You have individual stocks. Oracle's up another 1.5%. We've got Micron up 4%. There's no top. It doesn't appear in any of this stuff. There's no number. Whenever you see something down, you just got to buy it. I mean, Palantir's up another 2%. Even though they have virtually no revenue per share. You know, it doesn't mean the company's not going to make a lot of money 10 years from now. But
AI.
Yeah, well, then there's always that. So who did New Orleans lose to or beat?
The Giants.
Wow. Now, the Giants have made all of a sudden, the last few weeks, they've been better, right?
They have been better, but Skibo went down, and we don't know. I think the funniest thing on the Giants is they got rid of Daniel Jones. He ends up with the Colts, and the Colts are winning.
Colts got a pretty good team. They got a great offensive line. I was watching the game yesterday. They were just pushing people around. They got the kid from Notre Dame at left guard.
Mm-hmm.
Was his name Jensen or? But he's all world. So the Bears' offensive line looked a little peaked again yesterday.
Unfortunately, they did. You know, we started out pretty good. I was listening to the post game. And at least Williams admitted, he's like, we can't punch it through. We should have been up 14 points. They were driving, and then they just could not punch it through.
Well, so just quick summary for those that aren't necessarily Bear fans. First quarter, the Bears looked like all world. 125 yards, the other team had like 40 or something.
Yeah.
And they got down there, and instead of coming away with 2 touchdowns, they came away with 2 field goals. Then the other guys come and score, and all of a sudden, they're still losing, you know, a yards per game, 2-1, 2-1, and then they end up leading. And as soon as I saw that, I go, this isn't going to go well today. And sort of it didn't. They're missing Cole Kmet, who's solid with them because he's a good blocker, he's a good everything. The kid from
Colston from Michigan. Yeah.
Is he any good after the number one hype, number one pick hype?
He's pretty good. I think our biggest problem was is that, you know, Caleb was focusing in on Adunze pretty too much. I still think he holds the ball a little too long.
With that line, yeah.
You know, I mean, a couple of times he was getting rid of it quickly, but sometimes he always looks for that big play and, you know, like, but you were right. That first quarter, I mean, they had the ball almost 9 minutes, but only walked away with 6 points.
Yeah.
And that's pretty impressive. I mean, they were moving the ball down the field pretty efficiently. You know, but there's always next week.
Who are they playing? They're playing the Browns, right?
I believe so. Now, that should be someone we could beat.
Yeah,
if the
plane goes down.
If the plane does, yeah. I mean, I hope we do not go on a 10-game losing streak as we did last year. We play the Cincinnati Bengals in Cincinnati. Now, Joe Flacco had a horrible game yesterday.
Well, when you go through, what do you suppose, for those that don't know, is gambling as you can tell by the people in the NBA, and it's gambling. We're going to go to break here in a second. It's gambling is getting out of hand, but when the Baltimore, well, it didn't matter because Baltimore won by a bunch, but the Baltimore quarterback was supposed to play, and he's like MVP guy. So the Bears are 6.5-point dogs. I'm curious as to what the game went off as, because then all of a sudden he wasn't going to play. And I remember, you know, leagues used to a big deal about this guy. I remember when I was really young, Jimmy, probably before Jimmy, the Bear, Papa Bear, Mr. Know-It-All, or Mr. Control the League guy, actually got a pretty sizable fine because he said Gale Sayers wasn't going to play and he did, or the other way around. And Gale Sayers was worth, you know, what do you figure, 7 points in the betting line?
True.
And he was that good. And somehow or another, he I won't say he putzed it, but he didn't say who was kind of on purpose, that kept it a mystery as to whether Gale Sayers was going to play or not. And he got a pretty good fine. This was 1967 or something, 66.
Really? Okay. You mean the foundation, George Halas, of the NFL?
Well, the idea, I don't even know what it is today, but when you put out your injury report, doubtful is, let's put it this way. One of them is 25, one of them is 50, one of them is 75% chance to play. There's doubtful, what are the other two? Doubtful is 25%.
Doubtful, maybe.
Yeah, there's the other two categories. I don't know if they use those anymore. But
probable
75% chance of playing.
Probable, doubtful, probable, and out are the three ones that I know of.
Yeah, doubtful is less than 50% or something. Probable means 75%, whatever it was. And he, I don't know what he did. He had Sayers is doubtful, and of course he played or something. And so they would. So now I don't know. Well, this guy in Baltimore, you don't really see that much anymore. But so they said because he participated in practice on Friday, the media took it to mean he was playing.
Well,
on Saturday they said he wasn't because he had a hamstring wasn't healed enough yet, right?
Correct. They said that he went. Now on Friday he practiced with the practice squad. So he didn't practice with the. He wasn't backup. He didn't practice with the team. And Saturday they made a decision. But yes, the media kind of was going out on a limb he was going to play. Now the question is, they play Thursday. Is he going to play?
We're playing Miami. I think they can beat Miami without him.
I would say if you don't have to put him in, why do it?
Yeah, then he's got another 12 days or so, 10 days. We SP Futures up 55, Nancy Futures up 321. So let's do a full report here because stuff's going on. We'll be right back to Mr. John Flanagan.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks,
Stocks and Jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
My advice to you, start drinking heavily.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Matt Byrne on the board. Jim Lawler in studio. We should have Mr. John Flanagan on Zoom in a second. SB Futures up. John Flanagan, we saw on Saturday. There is a sighting. He does exist, right, Jimmy?
Yes, he does. He gave me a ride home.
Yeah, got you home there, in one piece. And
he did, absolutely.
SB Futures up 54. NASDAQ Futures up 316. We have the Dow up 239. Virtually everybody's up here, except for, this is what's so crazy about all this stuff. Now we're gonna stop all rare earth shipments. Now all of a sudden we think we have a deal there as well. So the stocks here in this country that people have been trading the last week, we had a lot of clients that are trading this stuff. Critical metals down 8.5%. U.S. rare earth declined 7.2%. Trilogy metals down 5%. MP materials down 5%. Energy fuels and Neocorp down 4% and 6%. So this stuff is amazingly market moving, and boy, if you're privy to this information, if you can't trade this, you must get an F in trading or something. What did my mother used to say? She's a very good bridge player. What, Jimmy? What's the term? One good peak is worth two good finesses.
I believe, yes.
That's the anyway. Because I used to play bridge a little bit. Finesses were always kind of cool. Well, anyway, over in Europe, we got everybody's happy here this morning. Actually, the DAX not down 12. Call that flat. FTSE up 4. That's flat. And a CAC round up 1. So Europe, not so happy. Just they're just being Europe. Nikkei up 1,200 points. They're happy. 2.5%. Hang Seng up 273. 1%. Shanghai up 46. 1.2%. Boy, if all these leaders aren't the richest people on earth, there's something really, really wrong with them. Bonds up 3 basis points. 4.03. So back over 4%. But no big deal there. The Bund unchanged. 2.63. We've got oil down 22 cents, 61.28. Brent down 24 cents, 65.70. Gold, whack, whack, down 94 bucks, 4,042. So it's down from 4,300 in really a week. I'm not sure. Silver down a buck 25. Gold lower despite U.S. inflation data. The inflation data was not that great, but I guess it was good enough. We've got crypto up 1,900 points, 115,500. So back up from the 107 low. And we have FX. We got the dollar 116 against the euro. Not much change there. And the pound about 133. So crazy stuff happening. Matt, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Bears lose.
Yeah, that's a bit of a stinker.
Hawks
there.
Lose.
It's nuts. It's all no good all around. But very quickly, October 27th, 2025, is currently 6:42 a.m. Weather in Chicago, 48 at Midway and 46 at O'Hare. High of around 56 degrees today. Sunny skies are expected, sunrise at around 7:19 this morning. Tonight, clear skies and a low of 45. Meanwhile, over in Phoenix, warm and plenty of sunshine, high of 90 today, low and 61 tonight. That's over to sports. The MLB Dodgers play Blue Jays in the World Series. Series is currently tied 1-1 with Blue Jays winning on Friday, Dodgers winning on Saturday. Tonight, Game 3 starts at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. NFL yesterday, of course, Bears lost to Ravens 30-16. Kind of a hard game to watch, going to be honest. Vikings also lose to the Chargers. That was 37-10. The Packers, they beat the Steelers 35-25. Packers right now have the highest winning percentage in the NFC with a 7.86, or I should say a .786, my bad there. 5 wins and 1 loss, though. Back to you, Chief.
Yeah, do we have Mr. Flanagan?
We do indeed, yeah.
So,
good morning, all.
So, for those of you other than hearing his voice, he does exist. We saw him on Saturday.
I had a really good time too.
It was fun. We had plus we had the Interesting. We do. My brother does an apple pressing every year to make apple cider. And so last week I was regaling everybody with going down to Indiana and picking all these apples and getting caught in a storm of storms on the way back. Well, Saturday is a 5-hour, 7 or 8 person operation. I mean, it's a big deal to squeeze, and you know you get. But here's, we think a drought doesn't make any difference. We've had kind of a minor drought in this whole area this summer, and last year I'm thinking John and Jimmy we had probably 440 pounds of apples, 430. This year we had 500. I'll take a couple off there because my niece made apple pie some of it. And I'm going to say you got the same amount of juice as last year. It was interesting. When I was out there picking apples, of course you had to taste one, right? So I take a bite into one. It was really good. But I noticed it wasn't quite as juicy as last year. It had all kinds of apples. So the combination of a huge crop, I think, and the little smaller amount of rain, you probably got a little bit less juice out of every apple, and it was kind of noticeable. I mean, like I said, it was the same amount of juice out of maybe 50 pounds less apples. So I don't know what you can do with that information, John, but, you know, it is information nonetheless, right?
Well, that's, you know...
Everything
had an impact on subsequent years, too, I think, when they try to catch up, depending on how moist or dry it is. So,
well, last year, I mean, some periods, I mean, I were in Audrey's area. She had... The hailstorm hit right when her pear tree was blooming. Did not get a pear. Imagine if that was your farm and you had a hailstorm on your corn, especially if the... We talk a lot about, I mean, you want all this crazy stuff I talk about. You say, well, geez, that doesn't make any... That doesn't mean crap to anybody. It actually sort of does, because if you're a farmer and you have your soybean crop or your corn crop, or wheat maybe not as susceptible. Not so sure about that. Or oats, wherever you're hedging. The idea is you put your corn crop in the ground, and if the prices go flying up, you're not in the speculation business. You're in the corn business. So if you put your corn in the ground and it's $1.50 to put it in there, and you see the corn prices run up to $4, you're going to sell the futures at $4. The idea being, if it runs to $5. Well, you're going to lose a buck on your future, but you're up another buck on the corn you have in the ground, your spot, your actual corn, called the spot. And but what if a hailstorm hits your farm? I mean, what if there were pear futures, and Audrey had 100 pear trees, and it sold pear futures? Or you see that a lot in Florida. People sold futures, and all of a sudden their particular farm gets a frost. That's why you got to be... This is way more complicated and much more interesting and people generally believe. I mean, there's no easy way to make money. No easy way to be a farmer. No easy way to be a trader. I mean, people have... What was the... John, did you ever go to that saloon in... saloon, lounge, whatever you want to call it, in South Bend on a Friday night that had the all-you-can-eat fish when we actually didn't eat meat on Friday?
Oh, yeah.
They had a pool table and a... That's right. We only went there on Friday nights, maybe only like 10 times. We had our string of bars. And on the wall behind the bar was a sign that said something, just remember, everybody else's job in the world is easy, and that guy's overpaid except yours. There's truth, something to be said for that, right? Well, yeah. Anybody can be a farmer. No, not exactly.
I mean, something like the Dust Bowl right on the heels of the Depression is bad enough, you know, in so many directions and throughout, you know, the ensuing decades, but there's localized droughts all the time where farmers are losing everything, and you know, the mortgages aren't getting paid and they're being foreclosed. And this is, you know, something that maybe doesn't make the headlines except in that county or a couple counties, but it's a crapshoot, really.
What do you think of your buddy? Who's this Treasury Secretary Bessent?
Bessent.
He actually, I don't know if he's in China, he came out and he said something about he feels the pain of the soybean farmers because he's a soybean farmer. And I'm going, wait a minute, I'm not positive on this, but didn't he, the guy that during Trump's first term and the soybean guys up there with the tariff in China lost all that money and all his farms went up for sale, didn't he buy some of them or something? So now he's a soybean farmer?
Yeah.
Does that make you a soybean farmer, swooping in on somebody else?
I guess in your mind it does. Yeah,
yeah, I get that. So if you buy two wrestlers, does that make you a wrestler?
Sure. This is the way people, you know, use their imagination, Tom, sure.
You know, I'll tell you one thing, Jan. If I had that mentality, boy, I'd have a lot more money. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I would too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you just had that view, oh man, this looks like somewhat of an anomaly. I'll take advantage of it or something. It's just kind of crazy stuff. But so, how'd you like being back with all the Southsiders, Jan? Interesting group. Eh?
Oh, yeah, it was great. You know, drove past my old neighborhood, and you know, it was great fun. So it was really good seeing everybody. I hadn't seen Dan in a long time.
Yeah, it was a.
Everybody there was really nice. I mean, the food
matter of fact, he accused you of not seeing you since college. I think there's been a few times since then.
Yeah, I know it's been since then, but you know, time gets away from you.
Yeah,
it was a very it was a nice day. You know, it got cold and kind of cloudy later on, but it was a beautiful fall day, really.
And there was enough food for an army, of course.
Oh, and great food too.
So anyway, how is it? I mean, Jan, this whole idea. I mean, I know, you know, your political leanings are a little less than mine, but this constant chaos, with the market moves in the middle of the chaos, I find this very unraveling to a certain extent, because I don't see it going on like forever. I mean, I don't know what the end game is. I mean, I probably should be longer, obviously, today for my people, because we are, you know, we have, obviously, I should have gotten out of the gold. It's 83, the GDX. It's back down to 70, but we got put, so it's not the end of the world. But what do you... I don't see this happening for 50 years. I don't see it happening for 10 years. I don't see it happening for another 2 years, really. I mean, this constant chaos, pouring money in the system, stocks run up. The big date is this week, because the money supply number is going to come out on the 28th. It's been delayed. I have a feeling that's going to be to the moon. Maybe it won't be, but it... Plus, really, I know you don't like the Democrats. I'm not so sure I do either. But how much more can we just lie to people about these numbers? I mean, do you think the CPI has to be run by the president now, or what? I mean, what stage are we at here? I can't figure it out.
Well, the political tension has been ratcheted up so high, and you know, there's gridlock, but there's also, you know, any kind of give or take or perception of weakness or whatever else is just like, you know, a pipe bursting or something, and everything scatters in that direction to get maximum effect out of it from whatever side. And I don't recall that kind of tension being so, you know, overheated for such a sustained period in my lifetime. The parties never had this kind of, you know, digging in of heels to the extent they've shown in the last 10 years. And what happens then is anything that occurs, whether it represents a change in policy, whether it's tariffs or the border, whatever else, it begins this you know, cascade of reaction where it becomes a question of political survival. When one side thinks this is where they're going to not just lose this issue, but they may lose their political power for the next, you know, quarter century or more, or even cease to exist as a political party. This is the kind of stakes that we're running around here, and the rhetoric surrounding the news and the way the news cycle is just exploding, you know, every 45 minutes or so in some other direction. It's exhausting for any consumer, you know, who's just trying to hold on a job or keep the family together. There's no patience to kind of keep up with it at that level. And you can see the fatigue effect it has on politicians too, where they're just kind of acting unhinged and bloviating and saying things they'd never say in more recent times. But it's just become an assault on the senses, and people just want to back off from it.
Well, I don't know what the I hate to keep using the, you know, things from the past and people controlling information. Because there's been people who have done this, and a lot of them have been bad people. And now we have people trying to do that on both sides, so I don't know if we have bad people everywhere. But I've never seen anything quite like, you know, the say the Vietnam era, Jan, which was, in a lot of ways, it tore the country apart more than now. But it was real stuff because people were getting killed, right? I mean, I'm not saying the news now isn't real, but it's kind of pocketbook money when you think about it. I mean, fighting for tariffs isn't the same as fighting for your kid's life, or if you're a kid sitting in the jungle somewhere getting shot at, right, with them pouring Agent Orange on your head. I mean, the stakes, I'm going to say, for individual was a little higher. Is that a fair assessment? Probably. I mean,
And remember what the political protest movements were like then, too. Not just about the war, but about civil rights and, you know, women's issues and gay issues. Everything was sort of in ferment. But you had protests that really did kind of move the needle on certainly on the issue of the war. And what looked to be, you know, the fringe, you know, Berkeley, California, you know, wing of the nutcase.
Well, Michigan had, that's where the Students for Democratic Society were, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, things like Kent State.
But they always went to the football game.
Yeah. But, you know, there was, people responded to the kind of, you know, protest movements that after a while began to sink in with their message, and people began to doubt what they had been sold or been told by, you know, the higher-ups, and ceased to believe it. There isn't that same kind of needle moving with the protest movements I see today.
There is here with the ICE people. That's causing some trouble here. I mean, the individual. I mean, I believe that. I mean, on Saturday where they arrested, they staked out a guy's construction site and pulled in some guy who was illegal. He's been here since he was four. Anyway, what I want to go back to is that there wasn't Newsmax that the second something came out in like Vietnam, there wasn't a station on either side, or I think Newsmax the worst, but then because they're more personal about it than the one man's opinion, but there wasn't a station that came out and said, well, there was a you know, a protest against Vietnam in downtown Chicago, and a minute later people were vilifying one side or the other, where everybody's a crook, this guy, you know. There was kind of none of that. You sort of stayed on the issues, I thought, a little more than we're doing now. I mean, as soon as somebody picks something up that this is the right's position or the left's position, the stations sort of just run with it. And there's nobody, I mean, I think that the, you know, I don't really have any, if I had more money than God, I would do my best to contribute to political campaigns. My first question would be, if I put an issue on the table, are you capable of reading it and forming your own opinion, or do you have to see what side it's on first? I think that's killing us. Where are you? Let's see. This chip is supposed to be green. Who says it's green? On the right. Okay, I'm on the right. It's got to be green. I mean, I can't do that. I don't think you were born that way either. Or trained that way. You're supposed to look at something yourself, make your determination based on your morality and so forth, and other people's help and other people's opinions. You're not just supposed to say, oh, this is what Trump believes, I'll roll with it, or this is what the other guy believes, I'm going to roll with that. That to me is such a weakness in mentality that I can't even go there. But that's all I see. Or am I just seeing it wrong?
You bring up the media and, you know, the quickness with which stuff, you know, explodes into the public consciousness and gets thrown around, and clips are shown over and over again in chopped up YouTube videos, and, you know, any podcaster can get a microphone and a pretty background to, you know, bloviate about it. You know, I sense now when I look back on it that the media was not the kind of shining emblem of disinterestedness or factual accuracy that the people kind of imagined that it was. And it changed really in the 60s and 70s. I mean, you can go back to the Kennedy assassination and the complicity of the media in all forms, print or...
Well, when you say complicity, though, Jan, it was an era, just to set the tone for people that are younger, it was an era where people wanted to believe. We had just come from a worldwide conflagration where almost, I won't say single-handedly, because other people lost a whole lot more people than we did, but we essentially set the world straight. That's a very egotistical thing to say, but we tilted the balance of power to where word of Churchill said, it is now safe for a ship to ply the oceans with commerce instead of looking for a torpedo up its ass, basically. You know, we if it wasn't for us, they'd still be fighting, probably, World War II, right? Or they'd maybe we'd all be dead.
What's left of them, yeah.
Yeah, but, so, I mean, we were on top of the world. We didn't want to hear about, on, you know, Omaha Beach if we would have used some of the inventions that the British had for landing on something like that, where you had these big things, ramps where you put them over the barbed wire and then have your people. I mean, Omar Bradley told them, basically, we don't want any of that stuff. Well, okay, so today, if somebody would have said, well, gee, you could have lost 30% less men, what the hell's the matter with you? In those days, people wanted to believe, they wanted everybody to be a hero 100%, right? You didn't want to hear about Babe Ruth's drinking. You didn't want to hear about Eisenhower's, practice run for D-Day, when they lost more people in the practice run, because what, the Germans torpedoed ships during the practice run than they did on D-Day, or damn near as many. Right. You know, nobody wanted to hear that.
And they covered it up, pretty much.
But it also was not what, it wasn't the time for that. It was a full-out effort where 95% of the people were either working, making planes, working, making bullets, doing something. You almost didn't want to have, it was such a team effort. You didn't want to let the rest of the team know that some of the people on the team were without clothes. I mean, I don't. It's hard for me to even describe it, John, but it was sort of different in a sense that we were trying to do something in 3.5 years that people had never done before in terms of, you know, producing stuff. I mean, just the idea of, okay, you need bullets and food in the Solomons. Well, that's cool. We're in San Francisco. I mean, just the little stuff that people now can't even imagine how you did it, right?
Yeah. Well, and there was, a variety of media viewpoints. So, for example, CBS early on turned against, the war in Vietnam. And
wasn't that early? When Walter Cronkite went over there.
And Eric Severite, then it became a campaign really against Nixon all through Watergate. And not all the media outlets were behind that at the get-go, but they were by the time Nixon resigned. But there was great variety and diversity in, say, print media or in the news magazines. You know, there were the conservatives, there were the left-wing ones, and they went head-to-head, and you could subscribe to any ones you wanted, and you have to kind of look between them to find out where you thought the truth lay. But there was an opportunity to get it from all different sides, and you could pick and choose and feel that you were informed. But you look at the way, the hostage crisis under Carter, and other things, inflation. It was easy to beat up on Carter, but the media really never let up.
And well, it was easy to beat up on inflation, even though it wasn't his problem.
Right, and he still came close.
Yeah,
closer than people want to recognize to beating Reagan, but. That was lost in the shuffle then, and then Reagan could do no wrong.
If he would not have gotten elected his second term, all the worst numbers were in his first term.
Right, but the media was gung-ho for Reagan. I remember the coverage of the Mondale debate, the whole Democratic campaign.
He was a movie star. He was the head of the Screen Actors Guild. I mean, he was part of the media.
Well, right, and they the media didn't even try to hide it, Then things tilted the other way towards the end when you had the Bork nomination and the Clarence Thomas nomination for the Supreme Court, and then the media started to try to get out from under the Reagan thumb because they saw it was a sinking ship at that point, and Reagan was senile in the last month of his probably. In his first term, but it was noticeable in the second term, and the media tried to cover that up too, just like they did with Biden. So it was a different party,
But he was a different kind of guy. I mean, he was not Trump. I mean,
I'm just saying that the media never backed off. Well, just because but they did have kind of switching allegiances where they weren't always left wing, but they were often left wing, and they were occasionally supporters of.
But left wing in those days, somehow, the points of view of the left, point of view of the left was almost different than, was almost interchangeable with some of the. You can't compare the left wing today or the right wing today to those guys. The right wing was nowhere near his right. The left wing was nowhere near his left. I don't think.
No, and
I mean, Nixon and Kennedy probably agreed on 90% of the policy issues.
Well, it's always been good business to pit these sides against each other. That's what sells media time and newspapers. No, nobody is going to buy something. Although today you can see it. You know,
yeah.
The media has just signed on to kind of one message that it wants out there, and it gets as much bandwidth as it wants to kind of spread it around. That's changed because of smaller, you know, and not even what we call news outlets. You know, people like Joe Rogan or Tucker Carlson are kind of shunned by their own organizations, but, you know, have shown that they've got a key to viewership and a following that the media
well, the
is
own,
kind of busy.
The regular organization, when I say, I don't know about, well, you watch the news at night. They've essentially abdicated from the national news. They just do the local stuff because they assume everybody's picking the other stuff all day. I mean, that's the mentality of it. I mean, you're not going to have Channel 9 with you know, correspondents in Europe like it in World War II. I mean, it's not going to happen. But the thing that's, I think the Vietnam thing is a very educational, and Jan and I are digging up pieces of it. When it first started, we were too young, Jan, but when it first started, you know, after the French left, and we were doing some stuff over there that God knows what we were doing. The CIA was always doing crap somewhere, it seemed. Well, nothing has changed. And there really wasn't any, that I can remember being really young, you know, media stuff against it. And if you were a patriot, you know, World War II families, if you think that this stuff today is tearing families apart, imagine the old man being a World War II vet and the kid saying his Vietnam thing sucks and I'm not going. Boy, you know, that's a different world. I mean, talk about a generation gap, as they used to say, right, Jan? But
yeah.
All of a sudden, a few things happened. I'm going to say the Walter Cronkite coming back and saying, I had no idea how bad this was, we can't win, or something along those lines. But the most poignant thing I've ever seen to this day, as old as we are, was the kid getting shot on live TV, and it was on a picture of Life magazine, where the guy shot the kid right in the head. As soon as this country saw that, they go, wait a minute. Whatever. Who was exactly shooting who in that picture, Jan? I can't remember. It was some guy from one of the armies. I don't know if he was the Viet Cong or the Vietnamese. It wasn't one of our guys. Some kid's about, 10 years old, walking down the street, and the guy walks up right next to him and shoots him right in the head, right? And the kid goes down. It was on the cover of Life magazine. Well, I'm not talking about every age in this country went by and saw that. If you were 5 years old, you went by and looked at that on the newsstand. You go, what the hell is that? I think toward the end of the war, and I was already in college when I could have gotten drafted. It turns out the year we could have gotten drafted, Jan, if we'd have gotten the wrong number, we wouldn't have gone to NAM, right? Wasn't that the deal? You lost your student deferment, but you couldn't go to NAM. My mom, you know, hey, mom married into my dad's family, you know, go figure. Well, his older brother got killed in Germany, and my dad came back from South Pacific with kind of a melanoma. They essentially punched the takeoff of the thing at Little Company Hospital, didn't go back for a second thing, and sure enough, a year later, he has brain cancer, and 3 years later, he's dead. You know, so we basically lost two family members to the war. I remember my mom telling me, you know, when this all started, if you'd have been of age, people in this family, we go serve our country. But near the end of it, she goes, this thing is, she never swore, she goes, this thing is such a disaster. We'd be talking about Canada. You weren't going to go die over there. This is crazy, what we're doing. And there's a lady that was so patriotic, it was scary. So you're right, John. During the whole period of time, even though the news media, it kind of shifted because of what they saw. I mean, Walter Cronkite was not a rabble-rouser, but he went over there and came back and said, I don't know what we're doing here. That was one of the big changes, wasn't it?
My brother and I applied at registered for the draft right before freshman year of college. We're twins, so we went together and registered simultaneously, pretty much. And I opted for CO status, conscientious objector. And I'll never forget the look that the woman, you know, taking the registration gave me when I opted for CO status.
Were you a silent Quaker that I didn't know about, or what?
No, I did not. And you know, my brother didn't do that. We didn't fight about it. You know, he did what he thought was right. I did what I thought was right. But I remember coming home and telling my folks what I'd done. I don't think I told them beforehand. My dad was just, you know, like he had lost a son or something. He didn't rant and rave about it, but I could tell, like, it just, infuriated him. And yet, you know, 10 years after that, in talking to him, he, like you said, he said, well, we could have gone to Canada. I could have retired then. We could have been. I remember, I can't believe he was saying this, because he didn't say anything like that in 1970. But his thinking changed, you know, over the next 10 years or so, looking back on it. So you kind of have to give people a chance to rethink things and not be so swept up in the idiocy of the moment that they're blinded to things. So,
well, you know, what do you mean, the stuff that's going on today, that is, I'll use the term, boy, here's one from the brinkmanship that we seem to be showing in some places, we, meaning our president, isn't this, I'm not privy to the information, John, so I don't want to be all that critical, but isn't people running around doing nasty stuff in speedboats in the Gulf, isn't that the job of the Coast Guard? Isn't that traditionally been their job? And now we're sending an aircraft carrier to go after speedboat? What are we doing exactly? They had some Republican guy yesterday saying he thinks we're going to invade Venezuela. How the hell are we going to invade Venezuela? Where do you even start to invade, for God's sake?
Well, you know, we did the same thing back at the birth of the Marines in the 19th century with the Barbary Coast, you know, pirates, and the impressment of U.S., you know, servicemen who were taken hostage and, you know, enslaved and everything else, and we didn't, you know, hesitate to go in and, you know, wreak havoc on the countries producing this, and that you know, if that is glorified in Marine history and in military.
Well, but we also they were doing this thing like in the Gulf, you know, type. But I mean, to me, Janet, you know, you're the attorney, but I remember the I knew him for a while when the guy was 90 or something, or middle 80s, Mike Tooman. And when he, you know, he died a while ago, in 2 years maybe, and he ended up being, he was on the appellate court thing here, and he was a judge in the Jeff Ford trial. I mean, he was a real serious guy. And he ends up dying, and of course, the people here were saying, well, maybe we'll get somebody more liberal in the child thing, you know, but... But when you talk to the guy, I mean, he was just so focused. But Bill Murphy, my friend, gave his one, well, he had a bunch of people talk at his funeral, and Bill Murphy got up and said, you know, Mike Tooman was a guy that he loved the law. He absolutely loved it. He goes, the reason why he loved it is not because he liked looking at books. He realized at a very early age is this is what sets us apart from animals and basically other people in areas that don't have any law. Because the idea that there is a process and that there are rules that everybody gets to behave by under the same rules, at least in theory, and that people have a right to a defense and all these kinds of things, the process, he said, people don't understand enough to know that the process is sacred. Because if you don't have it, you're an animal. Yet it seems to me, and I'm not just talking about one guy, who could care less about the law, it doesn't appear, and he'll care less about the process. And he's, and a lot of younger people, I think, feel the same way. I think it's not like he's figuring it out on his own. A lot of young people think that this was just kind of given to them, like, not just young people, now it's going to be older people, that this is just kind of given to them, that, and now the law is something to just be, it's something to get around. It's something to, if there's financial laws, you get around them. If there's trading laws, if you're big enough, you get the front run. I mean, this total disrespect for what guys like Tooman really realized was something so very special, I find very difficult to believe. I really don't care what Trump's, you know, if he thinks we should do this on the money supply. That's what you fight about politically. But this idea that we don't need any of this crap. We don't need Congress. We don't need this. By the way, it's my way. And a lot of people are buying into that. I find that horrifying, John, because how many people died? My uncle, my dad died for this process. And now what? We don't care about any of this? I mean, the idea that the House of Representatives being out during this thing and not even being available, I can't even believe that. What are they doing, taking themselves out of business? What am I missing here?
This kind of retaliation for what's perceived to be a threat happens in all different kind of scenarios. Remember Obama taking on, you know, U.S. citizens overseas with drone attacks and killing them, and nobody, you know, they just think about that.
Well, I'm not saying it's not a process, but that doesn't...
Right, but Tom, yeah. in any kind of a comparison between what's going on with the drug running international waters in our response to it. And for example, the Chinese weather balloon, so-called, that just drifted across the entire continental United States and nobody did anything. What was that all about?
Well,
I'd
yeah.
rather have a response like Trump's than Biden's response.
Well, what I'm saying is, I think in my world, which of course is disappearing rapidly, in my world, if you have people on the ground in Venezuela, okay, that are smuggling cocaine, and by the way, don't tell me it's fentanyl when it's cocaine. You don't have to do that. Tell me what it is. And be accurate, which this guy won't, or maybe Obama wouldn't either. Maybe the lying is a process, and he's just the last end of the... You do this, what you do, John, is you surround him with a couple of Coast Guard boats. You say, what's the word? Heave to? If they don't, you put a shot across their bow, and you put this all on film, and if they keep going and try and run down one of your boats, you blast them. I got no problem with that. But having somebody coming out and saying, I told them to just blow the thing up because I know what's on there and I don't really care about it. I want somebody to come out of there with a big bag of cocaine and say, here it is. Here's why we did it. I have some respect for that. I mean, am I just a nuts now or what?
No, but I have more respect for the deterrent effect of that. I'm more concerned at getting people scared enough not to keep doing this. You know, if we did it the first way and had arrest bait and had people interned here, if we had somebody like Biden, it would be catch and release. They'd be demanding amnesty now. So I don't want that.
Well,
I'm
saying they're
scared enough not to attempt to do
this. At some point, you have to come up with some evidence to say what you're doing is right. Don't you?
In whose court?
Well. There's a thing called the Declaration of Independence, which says all people get to have these rights, not just our people, not just white Republicans.
Yeah, but we have things like the Monroe Doctrine telling people that this country is hands off. How do we enforce that? What courts?
I never once said if we think they're bringing stuff here, we shouldn't do something about it.
Yeah, and I think what we should do is blast them out of the
water. Why don't we start with the white people here that are probably making all the money on these drugs? We can't do that, can we?
Well, what do you want to do to them?
The people that are selling it here, pick them up. Finally, somebody will tell you who's selling it to them. Walk up the chain. You might find, very surprised, you might find at the top.
Oh, yeah. They're sitting in Congress, Tom.
Well, okay. I'll do that. I'll be happy. The money is not being made on that end. It's being made on this end. Right?
Well, they need the cooperation of, the foreigners to get the stuff in here in huge numbers.
Okay, but no. If you stop economically, let's shift to the economic. If you stop 20% of the stuff from coming in, what'd you just do? You just drove the price up 40%. People here make more money.
So there's no solution, right?
No, I'm saying you got to. I don't understand why here you can't stop it here, in this end, because we find out. I mean, the person who's selling it,
Tom, they won't let ICE deport people for drug, human trafficking, you name it.
None of the people here have been arrested have been human traffickers. The guy here the other day we got arrested was been here for 25 years. He works construction.
Well, Tom, if there's 20 million, are we going to get it right?
There's not 20 million.
No, we're not. There's going to be detainments.
Well, and some people are believers.
To be let go.
Why?
But if we just decide we can't do it right to the letter in every case, we can't get every warrant just the way Governor Pritzker would like it for ICE to get cooperation from the state. So therefore we do nothing and we let the 20 million people just come and we all agree on the kind of amnesty we're going to give them. Screw that.
Why are people here? Why is somebody here 25 years paying his taxes, having a Social Security card, doing what he's supposed to be doing, has a bank account? Why is it so difficult for that person to be a citizen?
Well, it's attractive not to be.
I don't buy that at all.
That's got to be it.
No, it can't be. I think it's very difficult to become one, and it's getting harder. Next time you're on, Jones.
Well, it should be hard. Tom.
Why?
It should.
What did
be
you
hard.
Have to do? Just show up.
Well, if you want everybody to earn their citizenship, we're going to have to like.
Did you earn yours? Did you earn yours? I didn't earn mine. I just popped out one day and didn't die.
Well, that's earning it in my book.
I guess growing up when we grew up, having to go to school with nuns, maybe we earned it. I don't know.
I don't buy that we have to do something else to become a citizen if we were born here.
I'm not saying we did. I'm just saying.
But I do think if you're born here by people who have a right to be here in the first place, it should be, you know.
I'm not so sure my grandfather had a right to be here. He earned it near the end, I guess. But how do you know all your people got here legit?
I would bet you, Tom, he did, because you couldn't get a decent job if you couldn't prove what court you got your citizenship papers from and produce them. And you even have to do it at the polling place.
John, the guy'd be 130 years old now. He ditched his uncle and went to work on a railroad as a water boy.
Yeah, my great-grandfather worked on the railroads, and he became a citizen, took out papers the year he got
it. Yeah, I don't know.
And 6 years later, he got a citizen.
I don't know when he got his, but it was...
Tom, you did it because you didn't have a prayer of getting a decent job.
This was before
there was...
There was
no point to doing that. And people knew what the stakes were if they could work hard.
Are you kidding? This is before you hit a Social Security card, for God's sake. Did anybody get a job? You think they checked on anybody? 1922? I got to believe...
They did, Tom.
How? There was no...
For the good jobs. You had to produce it. You had to swear on a statement.
I registered
in this court to prove my intention.
I don't think there was any withholding of taxes. There was no Social Security card anyway.
No, but there's no employment if you didn't have that.
Hey, what...
I mean, you could work maybe as a rum runner, or run a still or something under the radar, totally illegally, and make enough money to become rich. But if you wanted to work as a...
We didn't have rum runners in Chicago.
Mills, the railroad, you had to prove you were a citizen.
Are you talking about Kentucky? Anyway, hey, what do you make of we don't have that much time. What do you make of the difference in the mentality here between these colleges and the pros and these coaches we were talking about earlier? You were listening on that at all?
Yeah. We talked briefly about this on Saturday, too, about allowing, the NCAA allowing college players to bet on pro games, pro sports.
Why is that even their call? I don't...
Well, that's true. Well, but what's the implication of that? What does that mean?
For those that don't know, somewhere, I don't know if I mentioned it on a Friday or something, the NCAA came out with a ruling. Now, college players are not supposed to bet on college athletics. Plus, you're not supposed to bet till you're 21 anyway, which I'm saying probably half the people aren't even 21, are they? Or maybe more than half. But now they came out with a ruling and said, I didn't know they had a rule against the 21-year-old college students betting on pro ball if it's legal in that state. I didn't know they had such a rule like that, or why would they even think of having a rule like that? I don't know. You don't want guys consorting with gamblers, but if you're playing tackle on Notre Dame and you're 23, and you want to make a bet on the Bear game, I guess I don't know why it was ever against you to do it, but it was. Then they came out and said, okay, college guys can now bet on, and ladies, can bet on pro sports. And I'm looking at this going, I don't know if I'm against it or with it, John. I just can't believe it. I read it.
Was there ever any enforcement of the negation? The opposite of that rule?
They don't have subpoena power to FanDuel, do they?
I don't know. Well, it looks like the NCAA did that for a reason, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the reason might have been. It's either that it's become so rampant and it's starting to infiltrate the interplay between college athletes and pro athletes, that they've got to, give the impression that they're trying to regulate this by giving you this, but preventing you from betting on college sports, which I suspect is going to be the next barrier that falls down too. You'll have college athletes betting on college sports. I'd be surprised eventually if they didn't have that.
The argument is, if I'm a Notre Dame basketball player, why can't I bet on college football?
Right. Well, I don't know how I would make a case against it.
I don't either. I mean, once you go down the road, you're like a snowball going downhill, eh?
Well, I don't think we've really begun to imagine what kind of erosion there will be in what last remaining integrity there is in sports, professional or collegiate, at the way gambling has taken over. I'm kind of done with the whole thing. I mean, John Cass, the old, Tribune guy who's gone off on his own now as a podcast, should be at a really interesting column from yesterday, the day before, about why he doesn't follow the NBA. He's got his own personal take on it, just what he's seen happen and the kind of image that the NBA has, or what a horrible image it has, I should say. But I could see, you know, people becoming equally disillusioned with, you know, other sports besides, you know, professional basketball, college basketball. They're all kind of ripe pickings for what gambling can do to it. And eventually it's going to be, how could there be any games on the up and up when there's so much money involved in the outcomes? Or not even just the outcome, but if you talked about it, with the, you know, the running out the scoreboard to fantastic amounts of money, because that's what the spread is on. That's what you're betting on. It's the number of points you're going to beat by, you know, your opponent. So it isn't just about winning or the losing.
Whenever there's money around, you know, at all levels of society, there's going to be somebody who tries to sneak around it. I mean, that's why everybody was so diligent on the trading floor, because there was money involved. And you had to be very diligent about somebody trying to not... The specter of being outside the rules was so profitable that, you know... Well, look what's happening now with the announcements coming out of Washington. I mean, what are the chances... Oh, by the way, to answer your question regarding how did they find out about it, I bet they were doing some sort of a cursory look at people... I don't know that the... You're the attorney... Can the NCAA call up FanDuel when they're kind of in bed with them? You think part of the...
They're a sponsor. What the hell?
Okay, but what I'm trying to formulate this question legally so my attorney friend, meaning you, can answer it properly. If I'm the NCAA and I decide to cut some sort of a deal with FanDuel or what's the other guy? Jimmy, who's the other guys?
DraftKings.
DraftKings. And if I'm going to cut a deal with them to be able to sponsor, commercials, let's say on NCAA games, or before it or after it, because people seem like talking forever before and after these games, could I slip something in the contract that said, you must allow me to give you a list of 10,000 NCAA athletes and you let me know if they're betting on college games? Is that... Could you get around the legal system, which it seems like everybody get around these days? I guess when you ask the question, how did they find out? I'll bet they found out because they were somehow finding out if people were betting on NCAA games, and found out a lot of them weren't. They're betting a lot of pro games, would be my guess. Now, how they would find that out is my question to you.
Well, depending, I don't belong to either of those sites. But whatever identifying information you have to use or banking information that you have to disclose, it's pretty, easily traceable if you just want to pick a couple high profilers who are making a lot of money and identify who they are, what their status is.
But I mean, could the NCAA cut a deal? I'm hoping the answer to this is no. Cut a deal where saying, can I send you a list of all NCAA football players and you let me know if any of them bet on college games? I hope that's not true. But how else could they find out?
I don't know what would stop them if they wanted to. So I bet they could.
Would you need a? I would think you need a subpoena for something like that. But I guess I'm getting old school here, aren't I?
Well, look what happened in COVID and with January 6th. Bank of America throwing any data, of anybody who was in the D.C. area that day with a Bank of America account. They just threw everything at the government. Willy-nilly and said, you do with it whatever you want to do.
There's
no subpoenas there.
There's the subpoena system, the new government, where they don't go through any of that shit. But question is, can DraftKings can NCAA become the government and say, you have to tell me? I hope the answer is to no, but I suspect it isn't. But I guess my question, what are your, how sacred is your stuff on DraftKings or FanDuel?
I don't think it's any more sacred than it is in any other transactional, act that you make. If it involves money and it's got to be a source for the money and there has to be a receiving account for the money, I'd say all bets are off.
Well, if Jan Flanagan, who knows, you might be a big swinging bleep. If you bet $1 million on games last year, and you bet $2 million. Well, say you lost $1 million and you won $1 million, which used to be a wash, right? Well, now it's not.
Yeah.
Now you got to pay. Your losses are only 90% deductible, which is crazy. So now all of a sudden you owe tax on $100,000. Can the IRS just say, hey guys, we want to see everybody's? And if it was a trading firm, they'd be your sheets, your trades, right? Can they access that? I mean, we send stuff to the IRS from PTI that we were supposed to get. It used to be that, you know, you sent just the amount of the proceeds and you had to fill in the rest. Now I think you send all of it. There's more Dan questions than me, but I can't believe that DraftKings just coughs up their stuff to, you know, Notre Dame. Do you? Or the NCAA?
I don't know. I couldn't rule it out, though. Tom, one thing, maybe this is for another show someday, but I remember the first time I started hearing about derivatives as a thing, you know, to be, you know, traded or to, you know, package, you know, investments with or whatever. And it was all about the complexity of, you know, this event subject to this event and this combination with this combination.
No, awesome. you're talking about, it's not really, well, anything that's a derivative means that the price of something is depending on the price of something else. So
it's not just that one thing.
I'm saying the derivatives that I deal with, like options, if you're trading corn or wheat at the Board of Trade, you know, if you're in the pit, well, now there's not much in the way of pits, but you're actually trading corn and wheat futures and soybeans. It's what's called the primary market. If you trade stock in the New York Stock Exchange, it's the primary market. Now, the options market is considered a derivative market because the price of the option is based on the price of the stock, one of the five variables. So that's, you know, that's not really what you're talking about. Go ahead, what you're talking about.
But, you know, the equivalency I'm thinking about is what, you know, FanDuel and DraftKings have done with fantasy sports, which is, you know, it's not. Who's on what team, and what does a team really mean anymore in the gambling market? It's your own team. It's the one you come up with. It's the one you invest in. It's the one you bank on.
Well, that's a third piece. So, Jen, that's when you're picking. Bearing. That's when you're picking individual people of any team, but the person doesn't know you picked them. Okay, that I think to a certain
that doesn't matter.
I mean, what I'm saying, but to that,
although Tom, don't you think that it could be disclosed? None of this information is so sacred that it can't be leaked. And if there's enough money riding on it, I'm sure
if you've ever been in one of those fantasy pools, you end up with like 10 people on your team. All right, so. If you pick this halfback, running back, and it's not the same as doing a prop bet on the running back, like I saw the other night. You know, is Jim Lawler gonna do 50 yards in the first quarter? It's not based on that. It's based on, you know, it's like based on a whole game, and you got a whole team, and the money comes down at like at the end of the year if you won. That's not the same as a prop bet. Like I saw the other night, you know, will Jan Flanagan get 3 rebounds in the first quarter? You're talking about something.
Prop bet is easier to investigate if you want to unravel.
Well, that's what they got these guys in basketball on.
Right. But that I'm suggesting that the fantasy element is a way of protecting or making it more difficult to explore whether something is fixed or not. So it's just creating a kind of a smokescreen and making it harder to determine if somebody has knowledge.
I mean, in theory, I think you're right, but boy, for you to get information that the Bears are going to throw 50 passes this week, I think you'd find a way to get a prop bet of how many passes he was going to throw versus getting him as your quarterback on your team. That's pretty far. Not to say it couldn't happen, but. Hey, what do you say
I'm assuming it could happen.
Yeah,
and then you have every player potentially one of these, you know, influencers. And that just kind of makes
the
whole idea of having a game kind of a joke, really.
Have you ever seen an office where everybody's in one of these fantasy pools and everybody's shaking their heads on Monday? Those guys don't look like influencers. At least the guys I know.
But did you get a people, you know, steering the bets and influencing the betting and, you know, rings of people who are saying, I got a tip. And maybe you got a tip from the player himself or herself. So, yeah.
I'd rather Jan Flanagan's going to score 40 points and he's got 37, and all of a sudden he says he's got a tummy ache and takes himself out of the game. That's more direct. Hey, why don't we bring Audrian, SP Futures up 54, and Nasdaq up 319. That's why I've been right at that spot all morning. We have Audrey?
We do indeed, yeah.
I see her name.
Audrey, unmute thyself.
She may be away from the computer or phone.
Yeah, she'll when she pops back in, she'll pop in.
She'll pop in, yeah.
So, Jan, what we would talk about Paul Harvey, page three. What when we talk about some of these debt numbers, of course, the market's way up again in the last couple of days, so nobody worries about it, but interesting discussion last week with Colin, a few people, I mean, with the, you know, the smaller banks, we forgot about that, right? That was 3 days ago. Allegedly having some loan problems on real estate, commercial. We've got stuff now, everything's okay in China. The gazillion dollars that they seem to owe everybody, they're gone. And all this, the money that we seem to owe everybody with the amount of you know, debt we have in this country, all of a sudden Trump and Xi, we have a deal and everybody's ecstatic, pretty much worldwide except for Europe. Somehow or another, Jan, there needs to be, I guess if you pour enough money into the system, there's never a comeuppance from that end, but there'll be a comeuppance on, you know, like I was talking about last week, the guys who have, if you just use the CPI calculation from 1990 before it was changed, you're talking 3 or 4 points higher than it has here for the last however many years. I mean, someplace, somewhere, you just can't keep borrowing and throwing money at stuff. I mean, you're in my mind anyway. It doesn't matter whether you're economics or lawyers. You go, wait a minute, someday there's a price to pay. But tell you what, we keep pushing it out, don't we? I mean, in the real estate stuff, I mean, how long, 2007, 2008, we had housing prices higher. The average housing price was mean housing price. Not the mean, the median, which means half the prices are higher and half the prices are lower. The mean housing price was a price where 85% of your population couldn't afford it. I'm going to say right now we're probably at 90% or 87%. It's worse than it was in 2007. You've got the people living in houses are okay because most of them got a 3% loan and they're okay as long as they can, as long as they don't have to move, right? We've got insurance costs through. What is this? Somehow or another, people just going to keep finding the dough or borrowing the dough or doing something, and as long as the stock prices keep going up and money comes in, are we okay forever or what?
Not forever, but yeah, you know, I don't know what's going to stop, you know, bring it to a halt. It might die a very slow, painful death, but I don't see it ending anytime soon because there'll be some, you know, feeling for some sort of government bailout, you know, take on a city's debt or its pension obligations or whatever to keep the ball rolling. And something like that's going to have to happen in a bunch of cities before we're through. If they continue to function as cities, if they continue to meet their payroll, and, you know, it doesn't look like they're going to cut expenses, so there's going to have to be more and more money thrown at them. And I don't find any kind of resolve to change that picture. There's no political resolve. There's certainly no financial resolve to do it any better. So,
see, I don't from an overall view, and we're gonna hope Audrey will pop in here if she's in there. I wonder what she's up to. From an overall view, Jan, you know, worldwide economics. It's not like I'm drawing a bigger picture here. The cities aren't really a problem because they can go broke. They end up in a horrible way being fixed, right? If you just all of a sudden can't make it, you're going to end up. But it's not the same as if the city just printing money and starting to spend it. This whole phenomenon that we're doing on the federal level, it's kind of never happened before to this extent. I mean, it has on various. This is not a new trick. I mean, the Dutch did it. A lot of people have done it, and every time the Romans did it, for God's sake. But every time it's come to somewhat of a demise. And now, this time, our guys, it feels so good while you're doing it, and you're giving money to the right people. The question is, what is, I mean, right now, if we all of a sudden yank the money supply back to where probably it ought to be, you're going to see the market valued totally differently. It'll be a lot cheaper. Would it be a crash? Some people don't have any stocks. Maybe they don't care. I don't know. But you're going to see, you're not going to see companies, you know, trading $500 with $2 revenue. I mean, you're not going to see, you know, fake stocks like crypto trade $100,000. I mean, if you pull back on the amount of dollars in the system, but you're never going to be, like people saying, you're not going to ever see a recession. Well, you're never going to see a recession. If you pour money in the system, the nominal GDP goes up, you lie about the inflation rate, and you're constantly positive on paper. But how much, you know, we talked about Vietnam, and one thing about the show is it's all kind of the same subject. We had people that want the World War II generation that want to be a believer. And all of a sudden it got to the point where, man, this thing looks like a bleep show over in Vietnam, right? I mean, even people who were tried and true, I'll say patriots, veterans, medal holders going, this isn't the same thing. I mean, at this point, how many people in the population have to say, well, they can say what they want, but last year I'm going the wrong way. I think we're kind of reaching that thing. There's some people starting to say that, not enough. Anyway, let's bring Art on. Let's change this. Art, how are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you guys?
All right. Were you muted somehow? You were on and we didn't hear you.
Yes, it all involved your dog.
Uh-oh.
So let's not even get started on her.
It's like a kid. Whenever she does something bad, she's my dog. But well, now, if I was there and I already take her for a walk and everything, she'd be happy.
Uh-huh.
Just saying. Yeah. God, Jan, she's this little Maltese. We go by this house where they got dogs. If there's not a dog out there, she's 19 with like one tooth. And if there's not a dog out there for her to bark at and say, let me at him, she's all pissed off. And what a person. When she looks in the mirror, she must see like a tiger or a lion or something. I don't quite get it, but anyway.
Maltese, they're great Maltese. I love Maltese.
They think they're bigger than they can possibly be.
Yeah, but, they're fearless. Yeah.
All about the attitude.
Yep. What do they say? It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. I mean,
all right, sorry. We have interference from the other one. Is there's a squirrel outside. Sorry. Go ahead.
You do have your animals. You're like Ellie Mae out there, for God's sake. You know, you got your critters. It's not just the dogs. It's
critters.
It's the dogs. It's the possums. It's the squirrels. It's everybody else running around out there.
Yeah, well, everybody's got to live somewhere.
Doesn't have to. So what? We're just starting to talk about real estate. You've said the market is opening up a little bit, eh? So what do you, when you say, explain that, who's opening up where? Are you seeing more first-time buyers, or what are you doing?
And you know what? It's getting busy again, and actually interest rates right now are the lowest they've been, gosh, I want to say, in at least a year. They're hitting around 6.14, roughly, which is pretty good. Compared to 7.5, 7.75.
It's a big difference. 6 to 7.25, 7.5 is a big difference.
It's a big difference. Yeah. There's a big uptick in activity. Okay, first of all, excuse all the listeners. I have a terrible sinus infection, so excuse my sniffling and snorting this morning. But yeah, it's been a busy fall. People are out there. They want things. I have several buyers who decided that now's the time, and it also seemed to be loosening up some of the listings. There's more listings on the market than there's been, I believe, since about March of about 2 years ago. So we've seen more inventory coming on and more people coming into the market, and the refi market seems to be picking up right now too. I think we're going to have a pretty busy spring coming up. I think it'll be a good, this is any indication, if we don't have a in our area right here, if it doesn't get to be 25 below and 3 feet of snow, we might have business through the winter. Where as same as we did a few years ago, 3% interest rates, where it didn't slow down for the holidays. It was busy all year.
But we don't want to blame. We don't
pent up demand sitting there. So this keeps up in this direction, you're going to see it being another busy year, a little more healthy year, I think.
Well,
maybe Nancy would see more of what I'm thinking about here in the way, you know, when people are applying for financing. But do you have a sense with the clients that you deal with that a lot of them have bounced back from tough times, say arising out of 2007, 2008, or bankruptcy or hard knocks, being out of work, and they're back on their feet now in a way that, you know, maybe it didn't happen in big numbers before this? Or is there still a kind of hangover effect of people who are struggling to get back on their feet financially and are not yet ready to, you know, take another leap into the market?
Yeah, I think I would bet that probably half or less have fully recovered from 08. If you didn't have a good footing going into that time, if you didn't have maybe your house and some basic recovering, I think was very difficult because it was a long recovery. And it was a tough time. I would say from 2008 to about 2018 that a lot of people were still struggling. And the ones who are still aren't struggling are just maybe never going to get back to where they were. I think that's part of the problem we're facing. The part that held on to their stock portfolio, managed to keep their house, or added, you know, hopped in and just put some money in it when we were just rebounding, they're doing probably from well to great. But if you lost everything, I think regaining momentum was very difficult for a lot of people.
To put numbers on what Aud's been saying here, because everything she's saying is absolutely correct, 6.25, then we're talking about a house that's 400 grand, and you're putting down 20%, which a lot of people can't, but if you did, 6.25, which Aud mentioned, that's $1,969 is your mortgage. If it's 7.5, it's $2,237. Now, to that, you got to add another $900 in tax, insurance, and other. So you're up to $2,800 at 6.2%, but you're up to, you're over $3,000. But now, a lot of places around here, the taxes are way more than $400 a month if the house is $400,000, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you could be
probably looking more at taxes, probably in the maybe $9,000 to $12,000, depending where you're at.
So it's more like a grand a month than 400.
Probably. Well, let's say 400. You're probably around 8,000, 8,000 to 9,000. Let's say, which is still a lot of money.
Well, the other put numbers on what other were also said in response to John's question. If you, and I'll be brief here because I want you guys to talk more than me. If you had a house in 2008, the median house price, I remember this because I did a study on it, was $235. So if you put 20% down, you're talking $45, say, so your mortgage is $190. The median house value went from $235. Where did it bottom out, Aud? $175? $180 somewhere in there?
What?
Where did the median house price bottom out at after 2008? It was 235. Did it get down to 185? Something like that, 180?
I want to say 190, 200 maybe.
Okay, let's say 200, all right? Let's just be nice about it. Let's say 195 because it works. Say it goes down to 195. Well, now, if you were forced to move, the $40,000 you put down, that's on your balance sheet. That's your equity. That's either money that you and your wifey saved, or she saved, or you saved, or somebody, or it was your gift from the parents, it was your inheritance, whatever it was, that 40 was yours. Now, what I'd say, and somehow or another, if you had to get out of there at that point and go somewhere else now and rent because you don't have another 40, you probably have never recovered because you're paying pretty high rent, probably someplace, for the last however many years. Now you're forced to save up 80 for the new house price at 400, because now if you put down 20, you need 80. That's what you're talking about, right? Are those people, because they're essentially, their wealth got stripped, they have never really made the recovery that most, if they somehow could have hung in there and the housing price came back, they got their 40 back and then some, is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, they were not able to hang in there and survive. They maybe had to liquidate a stock portfolio, lost their job, they had to sell the house. So they were not able to say, wow, here comes the upturn, let me participate in it, I'm going to invest again. And they missed the whole run-up of the Amazons, the Nvidias, what have you. Because if you just would have put your 20 grand in the S&P 500 and rode it up, you wouldn't have had any problems again. So unfortunately, when you were left with nothing, you couldn't catch up. So you could never catch up again.
Well, your equity in your house, instead of being zero, you not only would have gotten your 40 back, but if the same house is now worth 400, you're up to 200. So just right there, you're fine, right?
Yeah, and it's just it was just time because the quality of, I think this is what I can barely remember the 70s recession. I remember my parents being worried. And gasoline, okay, they can probably brace themselves who was younger, but I remember gasoline being like 22 cents a gallon. After the Arab oil embargo, it was over $2, which was horrifying to people. And again, it was the same thing that happened now. It was, and while everything adjusted and people got used to the prices came down, we got adjusted, everything never really goes back to where it was. And then you just cut, you adjust to the new normal. And then we became more prosperous. I think the 80s were truly one of our best decades for as far as wealth gathering for the United States. But you know, if people didn't have an opportunity to participate, that's when people get left behind. They either were afraid to or didn't have the wherewithal to do it.
Well, the difference,
you know, it looks, go ahead, John. In a way, as if, you know, when things hit bottom in 2007 and 08 in the Midwest, it took us much longer than it did elsewhere for the values to creep up again for, you know, homes. And yet the, you know, the high end homes, you know, generally did better. If you were in a high end neighborhood and you had a nice house, and you know, saw that happen faster. But the people who were stuck in homes not so, you know, attractive, or in neighborhoods not so hot, they watched their values really inch up at a painfully slow rate. But the carrying costs on the houses started to gallop. So things like insurance and taxes, you know, made it harder to hang on to the house, even though it wasn't like, you know, something
that's,
that was...
That's very true. It's very true. And but actually, in a very strange way, gave the housing market a huge push around in the suburbs, I believe, was COVID, because people were getting, they were fleeing downtown Chicago when they had to wait an hour for an elevator. People have short memories too, but I remember people calling and saying, I live on the 48th floor, I don't have a balcony, I have two kids, and it takes me 45 minutes to wait for an elevator so that only three people could be in there, and my wife has to wait another half an hour to take the kids outside. So we had people calling and saying, you know, they were just buying anything to get out of the city and selling those condos for whatever they could get. So it was an interesting development out of there. And those prices, when they got pushed up, they just kept on going then.
I'm having this vision of Audrey with the little dog in the morning having to wait for four elevators. And I don't think the dog's going to wait. Just saying.
What a nightmare. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, then you know what? That's a very real problem for dog owners. However, a lot of people have purchased downtown that little, it's like a low, a very low crate, and then there's a company, and I actually had this idea years ago. Too bad I never acted on it. They send you a fresh hunk of rolled up sod every month, and you replace it, you put it on your balcony, and it comes in small, medium, and large, and the dogs can do their business out there, and then you just get rid of a piddle pad
for your balcony.
God.
That's right. I thought about that about 15 years ago, and then I saw it at Shark Tank. I shouldn't have waited.
Well, the people in New York...
They've been rich and sleeping in late.
Well, the people in New York that live a whole, you know, whole generations in these huge apartments, and all of a sudden you the park across the street was closed. I mean... Every mother, or every, you know, every...
It was like the most ridiculous, most ridiculous time we ever lived through with sheer government stupidity. And I don't think anybody got saved by not getting in another elevator.
Yeah, I don't see
that. That's another story for another day.
But, you know, I think what we're kind of defining is when people talk about the recession of this, like when your parents were talking about the 70s, Odd, and, you know, and we lived through those. We were young, but we lived through them. I think there's a... I've never seen anybody write this. I probably should have. But then again, we're going to publish it. There's only kind of been two times, two glaring examples in basically the 20th, 21st century. Every kind of recession is the one your parents are talking about, where they had their house, the down payment was secure, they had their bank account, your dad was possibly not going to get any overtime or might get laid off for a while. You had some unemployment stuff that you could pick up. It's a crappy time, but I would call that a business cycle recession. or a income recession where your dad would make less for a while and then hopefully go back to what he was making. That's totally different than the 1929 and 2007 phenomenons where Grandma Flanagan walked down to the bank and the door hit her in the ass and they said, by the way, your savings isn't here anymore. Where they had, where not only got laid off, everything they had saved for that rainy day is now gone. It's the same.
That's the same thing that happened in the 2000s.
Except you didn't get thrown out of your house and lose your down payment. I mean, like 2000.
A lot of people.
Some did, yeah.
I just grew up in a Brighton Park in Chicago. I remember a lot of steel places were laying people. They were working minimal hours. People. I mean, gas at that time, imagine 22 cents to, it was like 2 1/4. I can remember because, you know, everybody's like in a crunch going, and groceries correspondingly, you know, a loaf of bread, if you could imagine, was, you know, what, 50 cents?
Maybe.
And maybe, you know, 40 or 50 cents. And that went up to like over a dollar gas. So it was, again, a huge shock to the lower to middle class who hadn't, most of the, you know, people didn't have a lot of cushions that, I mean, my parents were lucky, their house was paid for by that time, but it was the same systemic shock to the group that could least afford it.
Well, you know, this is maybe a discussion next time you're on. It's an ugly one, by the way, but it's a piece of history in Chicago, and I don't know about any other. Is, maybe that's a question for Jan, because he's Mr. Historian, and Jimmy, who's lived in other places. When you first, the balance sheet hit the houses here is also the cause of, you know, was the cause of a lot of the latent racism in the city, right, Jan?
Oh, yeah.
Because we were, when I drove Jimmy down to the south side a while ago and was saying, look, this, you see these major streets, they were, quote, the line between the white neighborhood and the black neighborhood. And all of a sudden, for whatever reason, 10 years, 15 years later, somebody would cross over. And then there would be, you know, a couple of firebombings and all kinds of hue and cry. And then 6 months later, all of a sudden, the black community was 4 blocks or 8 blocks further west. All those people in the middle, they might have a house that was worth 20 grand. And as soon as, you know, one or two black people moved in, who probably had, you know, all kinds of, they had the income like the other people, were not going to cause anybody any problem, but all of a sudden, you had these real estate agencies that, what'd they call them? What was the name for them, Jack?
They called that blockbusting.
Blockbusting, where they'd call you up and say, hey, buddy, hey, Flanagan, your house is worth 20 grand. I can get you 18 for it tomorrow, but if we get 3 or 4 more, you know, these people in here. And a lot of those people puked those houses out at 11 or 12 and just fled. So in that area, it was almost like the Depression. It was almost like, you know, 2008, only worse. Even though it was very localized, but it's not like it's never happened before, right, Jan?
Yeah, and even you know, the area that became Robert Taylor Homes and Stateway Gardens, wedged between the train tracks, sort of, you know, just east of the Van Ryn Expressway, that, you know, historically was, you know, had some of the shoddiest, poorest built homes, you know, ramshackle frame places that, you know, went up in no time and fell apart in no time too, and that's where, you know, the blacks were directed to live for, you know, redlining with insurance, and, you know, couldn't get a mortgage.
Well, a real lot of them lived where the Dan Ryan now is.
Right, and then when they, then it was completely obliterated, it kind of almost, by some horrible sense of, you know, history repeating itself, that became the projects.
Also, yeah.
It was just a concrete reimagination of what had been a pretty hideous, you know, frame, balloon-style construction, house after house that was in terrible disrepair. That, you know, kind of mirrored the racial boundaries on both sides. So it's become kind of frozen in, you know, the footprint of the way the city is developed and the way it's laid out and the way it decayed. So,
well, you look at the expressways, the Dan Ryan, I think, I don't know about now, but I bet it still is the second biggest people moving project in the history of this country. Where people had, I mean, you're talking about something that's basically 12 miles long and I'd say at least a third of a mile wide, maybe a half mile wide, right?
Yeah, and it's, and well, it's, with the construction work, yeah.
Sure. And it's, it, well, what was there before? People, duh. I mean, Kennedy the same way, but not so much Stevenson because that was on the I&M rights, but Kennedy the same way, Eisenhower the same way, but the Ryan's a lot bigger. So, I mean, The only project, everybody's going to say, what's number one? The only project that moved more people was the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking about, you know, when you look at the 1960 number of Chicago, or 1955, there was like 3.1 million people. And I'm going to say there was, what, 250,000 people that were moved from the Dan Ryan? Some stayed in the city,
right,
some didn't.
It's a really densely packed population center. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, hey, we need an expressway here. You need what? Right? I mean,
it was Eisenhower's project.
Yeah, well, Eisenhower was,
it
was
Connect America, which changed everything.
Yeah.
When people could move faster, move goods faster, move themselves faster, people started going on driving vacations. I mean, it literally changed the face of America. It was a very interesting time.
Well,
I can remember when I was a kid, my dad used to love to go fishing, and we would drive up to the Chain of Lakes, which is close to the Wisconsin border. And we would get up at like 4 in the morning, you know, pack everything and drive up there on 1245.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, years later, you had, you know, the Eisenhower and the Northwest Tollway. And, you know, it's like an unbelievable game changer. But then all the Bon Pa diners went away, all the little stores. It totally changed things. When you look at where the big box stores came in, it's amazing the progression of things in that time frame.
Well,
since the 50s to like the 80s, I think.
Well, after my dad had his first brain surgery, where they figured they couldn't do anything, but they said, you'll be all right for a while. Well, me and my mom, he always wanted to go to San Francisco, California. So they hopped in the 51 Dodge and drove out Route 66. This is long before there was any interstate. And then they went up the coast and came back the northern route. Hear my mom tell about the drive. She goes, well, it was so damn hot in Arizona and something, you only really could drive at night. Because daytime, the tires were so bad, the sun would be, your tire would blow out. Remember that, Jack? The tire would overheat and blow out. And if you look at those real old cars, in the back they had that piece of metal that kind of covered half the tire. And people kind of thought it was for...
Oh, the mud guard. Yeah.
Well, but it was for mud. It's to make it look cool. No, it wasn't. It was to keep the sun off the tire. So it wouldn't. My mom said, the food on 66, the bathrooms. She goes, everything was horrible. She goes, the northern route was better, except she said coming through the mountains in the 51 Dodge was no trick. You know, can you imagine going up and down mountains in those things? Anyway, they like San Francisco. So the rest of it, she said, you could have kept. She wasn't a big Route 66 fan, but I mean, that's what you mean. To go to Arlington Park, the south side, you had to take LaGrange Road. There was no expressway, right?
Right. That's right.
I mean, it was all this stuff was a day proposition. When my grandfather always, you know, didn't spend a whole lot of money on cars. They would drive to Columbus. It would take all day. You know, you're on Route 30, you're on, and two times his car conked out, and he traded cars with the farmer. Gave the guy like $30, took his car the rest of the way. He ended up the trip with a different
interstate
car.
Interstate commerce.
Yeah, interstate. Can you imagine ending up the trip with a different car that you started out with? It was no big deal. The trip was the vacation, right?
That's a great story. You know, Kobe, if you think about it, this was all, I think the interstates were actually the beginning of the demise of when you grew up in your neighborhood. Once you were free to move around, then you stopped living by your aunts and uncles and your grandma, and people started living farther apart because it wasn't that far on the highway. So a lot of the little lifestyle that kids only know from like Andy Griffith and Leave It to Beaver and things like that started to disappear with the advent of all that.
Right. And the bypasses drew all the businesses and, you know, the population center away from the city centers. Yeah. So, you know, people didn't want to drive through, you know, Route 31 all the way down to Indianapolis and Indiana. You go through every little town. So, you know, you take all these bypasses, then...
Yeah, but now all of a sudden the Walmart's on the bypass and all the lights are there.
Nothing downtown.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we're nearing the end here. What you think it's the places in Florida and Georgia and Texas that roared in there, like the Black Racks and stuff, and just bought up all these houses, they're seeing some pullback on the prices. Do you think that's they just got too aggressive, that that's going to be localized down there, or you see that spread?
I think right now, you're, from what I've just been reading lately, everything seems to be stabilizing pretty much, and you're starting to see growth again. Interesting, in Florida, a little bit off the oceanfront is becoming popular. You know, a lot of some people, maybe I don't have to live 10 feet from the water. You know, I'll live a couple blocks in where I could either get insured or my house won't be gone, you know, when the storm comes through. But Texas is, there's five or six cities in Texas, little smaller ones that are enjoying some really big booms right now because of all the, you know, technology, technological firms relocating. A lot of relocation there. And the whole, what's that called? It's where like Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, and something. There's a name for the, where those four states intersect. They're experiencing a huge real estate boom right now because of massive relocation to some of these high-speed data centers that they need for all the AI and stuff. It's like Arkabama, Loma, something or other. It's the name for those.
Well, Texas got big water problems. When last time Bill Moriarty was on, he said some cities are denying permits.
This is a little farther north in the Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama area.
Well, if you're in a swamp, you got a lot of
towns are turning overnight now into boom areas.
Well, if you're in Alabama or Mississippi, you know, if you're in a swamp, you got water. Just saying.
I'm sure you could unswamp it with the right technology.
You're not getting me anywhere. You got alligators and mosquitoes. I'm not going there. Just saying. Imagine if we had
air conditioning.
Yeah,
you got an air conditioning house.
What are the rates now? 6.25, you said, or below?
What?
The rates are 6.25, you said?
That was like you have to check locally. I just saw that pop up yesterday. But I would say you're hovering right around there now. If you're interested in taking a look, call your broker. Better yet, call Nancy Long Graham, and she'll give you the best quote around. But it's a time to be thinking about it. And we may have supposedly another rate, one or two cuts coming up.
We should have a cut this week.
It's really going to shove the market. And I don't know about you, but I'm getting eggs for $1.99 a box now. That's pretty exciting. So life is good.
Yeah, well, I got 15 dozen extra large at the depot for $30.
Well, aren't you just hot stuff?
You ended up with one of them, didn't you? So there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. SP futures up 57. NASDAQ futures up 330. Everybody criticizes my shopping job, but they're happy to put their hand in there. You know, it's just the way the world is. You know, like,
I'll eat it any day.
Yeah. Hey, what'd you do buy all those eggs for? By the way, are those eggs? They look pretty good. Jimmy, thank you. Matt, thank you. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.